All right, so we're gonna. How are you doing, Brian?
Yeah,
usually
Charles.
It's Eric.
I know.
It's great to see you again.
I'm just co-Eric.
No, you're exactly.
Actually, you know, he's co-Brian.
Exactly.
So he thinks, you know, he thinks he's something special. He's just co-Brian.
Right on. So hey, it's great to have you here in Australia, man.
It's great to be here. We're having a ball.
Awesome. So this will be an expert-to-expert interrogation of a very special guest.
Yes.
And I believe the topic is coffee script.
Yeah, Michael Ficarra.
Yeah.
And I saw your talk on the new compiler for coffee script. Mm-hmm. And just want to ask you a few questions kind of around the vicinity of the topic. Because I have just recently come off writing a large-ish application in JavaScript, knowing nothing about JavaScript when I started, and finding out all kinds of interesting surprises.
Ah.
Such as if you write a function and you pass it console.log, it's not at all the same as writing a function and passing it function of round brackets, curly braces, console.log.
Yes. Yeah, there's a special syntactic form, depending on how the function is called, where it was attached and how it's called, the context changes. And
yes.
Log function isn't really isn't pure. It depends on its context.
Yeah, somewhere in there, somebody's going to use this, and it's going to be bound to something that you don't have any idea what
it is. So it has to be called directly as console.log, otherwise you have problems.
Now, what this does is it interferes with the intuition that a functional programmer develops, and that intuition is functions are equivalent to their eta conversions.
Referential transparency.
Exactly. Yeah. If I have f, it's exactly the same as the lambda of nothing that calls f.
Yes.
And that doesn't work in JavaScript. But otherwise, JavaScript is almost functional, in my opinion.
Well, you have first-class functions, and that certainly helps.
It certainly helps. And the intuitions that I developed as a scheme programmer work really well in JavaScript most of the time.
Well, not everything has a value.
Give me an example of what you mean.
Most statements are not values.
Ah, yes, statements. That's correct.
Well, though they do have completion values, so they do have values defined. You just have to find out how to get them.
Oh, that's interesting. Give me an example in that.
So for example, the eval function takes a string and it produces a value, which is the completion value of the program that's inside of it.
Ah.
So it may have a statement, something for which a value is not defined, but for eval, the completion value is defined. So, for example, the conditional will produce undefined if the condition is failed inside of an eval.
You mean if the false branch is taken in the conditional?
Yes.
You mean?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
But really, you can never use that value outside of producing the completion value inside of eval. Little known bit about JavaScript, I guess.
No, but these things are important little factoids, especially if you're writing a certainly if you're writing a compiler.
Yeah, you need to know everything about your compilation target if you want to.
If you want to have a half a chance,
yes.
Yeah. But it's also useful if you're writing applications because as you start to squeeze the applications, get a little bit more perf, maybe do, inline things, unwind loops. You know, start probing the dark corners of the language. You will run across these kinds.
Well, especially performance in JavaScript, it's usually unwise to do that. If it's performant today, we may find that with how fast they're developing these interpreters, that doing it a different way might be more performant later. Most optimizations like that are premature.
Very good, very good. But sometimes they're not avoidable because you just have your application reaches a cliff and you have to do something.
And sometimes they are inherent to the language and you're pretty sure that they will be more performant in the future.
Right. Yeah. So now what I want you to do is help guide me, because as I look at JavaScript and I contemplate rewriting my application again, I have now too many choices in front of me. I've got TypeScript, I've got LiveScript, I've got CoffeeScript, I've got ECMAScript, I've got all of these possibilities. What should I do?
Well, I'd certainly not recommend that you write most of your programs in just plain old ES5 nowadays.
Right.
Because there's just no reason to. If you are just write CoffeeScript, or I guess if you prefer having your static type checking in. Right, you may choose TypeScript, but there's really no reason for somebody to use JavaScript directly at this point, especially after my compiler, which has the source mappings. You can debug it within the browser as if it's executing in the browser. You can set breakpoints and inspect variables as it's running.
Okay, tell me a bit about how that works. I'm trying to picture it in my mind what it would do.
Part of my presentation, but I show some examples of it. You can see in the WebKit inspector, where you normally debug JavaScript, and you can set breakpoints on JavaScript lines and inspect values in the JavaScript code. You can treat the CoffeeScript the same way when we generate this source map. So the V8 guys have done something really awesome, or I guess the Chrome guys, whoever works on the WebKit inspector for Chrome. They've done an amazing job with that, and I'm just reaping the benefits, really. And especially, I'm using a Mozilla's library to generate these source maps, too. So it wasn't much work for me other than actually preserving the source information to the output AST.
Now let me see if I get it, if I understand it. The source map maps you from the internal JavaScript that the debugger is actually working on back to your source in CoffeeScript.
Yes, yes.
And then the displayer shows your source in CoffeeScript.
Yes, yes. And the only work I have to do is preserve the source position information when I parse it through to the JavaScript AST that my compiler produces. And when I do that and I give it to the code generator, the code generator generates a concrete syntax tree and passes that to the Mozilla source map library, which will create a source map from it.
Okay, this is very typical debugger interface for, okay.
And now we have it on the web, which is good.
Now, when you're compiling CoffeeScript, how much of JavaScript do you actually use? How much of it do you probe? Do you generate code that's a kind of a three-address code, or do you go really deep?
I'm not sure what you're asking. Are you asking when I make the compiler?
No, the code that you generate, the JavaScript code that you generate, there are a bunch of different ways that you could go about it. When we were doing the IL to JavaScript compiler, we just said we're going to treat JavaScript as if it were an assembly language. Mm-hmm. We will just do essentially we'll generate three-address code, mm-hmm. very spare stuff, do trampolines and go-tos, and not try to make any kind of source-to-source mapping, as it were. We just treat JavaScript as if it were just dumb. Mm-hmm. So we didn't actually end up probing any dark corners of the language on purpose. We just wanted mm-hmm. to use it in a spare way.
So since CoffeeScript actually shares almost all semantics with JavaScript, we should take advantage of much of the behavior that we already have. For instance, simple member access works the same way in CoffeeScript as it does in JavaScript. It walks the prototype chain, and when it hits the end of the prototype chain and it doesn't find anything, it produces an undefined value. Right. And all of this, and if those semantics are exactly the same, we can compile simple member access to simple member access
in
JavaScript.
Okay, very good.
So we actually do want to take advantage of many, many of the features. I really like to think of CoffeeScript as just an alternative syntax for JavaScript that you should be writing, so for well-written idiomatic JavaScript, we actually want to compile to similar constructs in JavaScript to take advantage of all the other behavior that's already been defined for us.
Okay, good, and that's because the semantics of the two languages are so close that
very close.
Unlike IL, which has very different semantics from JavaScript, and you're taking a big chance if you try to do while loops and for loops into for loops, who knows what objects are. The inheritance goes the other way around, because it's a virtual dispatch in .NET as opposed to prototype walking in JavaScript. Mm. And we don't want to model that at all.
No. So,
tell me a bit more. I've never used CoffeeScript. Take a few minutes and sell me on it. Tell me why I should use CoffeeScript. I just looked at it, kind of skimmed the page, and it looks a little bit like Miranda, or it was familiar functional notation with the offside rule, and
somewhat.
I saw little thin arrows and fat arrows, mm-hmm. and I thought, oh, that's interesting. That probably has something to do with this binding stuff. Mm-hmm. And from that, I didn't really study it.
Well, pretty much the biggest reason anyone should use CoffeeScript is that it expresses your intentions much better than the equivalent JavaScript.
Okay.
So even though each construct compiles usually to one construct or set of constructs in JavaScript, you your intentions are specified better. So when you come later and read it, or if somebody else is reading your code, which sometimes happens in the real world.
Well, that's the truth. Yeah.
Then they know what you intended, the behavior you intended, rather than the canonical example is the list comprehensions that we have. You can specify a list comprehension, and rather than specifying as you would in JavaScript an iterator that you would start at zero and increment and go through each element of an array and make a member access, and then like start a new list and push things onto the list, and that's all the scaffolding around what you actually want to do. Then you actually have your behavior. If you could just specify all of that around me plus this in a very succinct way, just say comprehension that does this.
Sure. It'll either do a transformation or a filtering or a fold or whatever.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, okay. So that's very familiar from functional programming. Mm-hmm. And link is essentially another way of doing that kind of thing. The link standard query operators, they don't visually look like comprehensions, but they give you the semantics of comprehensions and the robustness of operating as if you were using comprehensions. You feed it lambda expressions and it performs a map or a filter or whatever you want to do.
As you mentioned, like the fat arrow is another way of succinctly representing a very good, very common good practice. So saving a reference to the context in which you're defining a function and then referencing that context within it is a very common pattern, but it also has that overhead of we have this extra temporary variable that we want to reference every time instead of the actual context. This just hides that for you, and you have this very small difference. The thin arrow and the fat arrow only have that one difference. Everything else is the same. So that's the only thing that needs to delineate those two.
But that's nice because most of the time, if you're not thinking about it, or you're writing a function that might refer to it to itself, you really want to have that closed over reference.
Not refer to itself, but its context.
That's what I meant. Yeah, you want to refer. You what you want is a variable that refers to the context that is lexically scoped. That's what you want,
yes.
As opposed to this dynamically scoped thing
exactly
that catches you,
and that's what the fat arrow does for you. That's a very common pattern in JavaScript. It's not like that's just among advanced JavaScript programmers, that everybody has to do that all the time.
You see the thing, and it's in Douglas Crockford's blogs from way back, and it's all over the place.
Yeah, so you might as well have it be
automated.
Specified nicely. Yeah,
have it part of the language. I think of using that as a kind of prophylactic programming. Sometimes when you're writing code, you don't know how all that code is going to be used, and yet you don't want surprises later on. So you write something that maybe is a little bit safer than it needs to be because you don't know where it's going to go. Mm. And
we do try to advise against the overuse of something like the fat arrow. When we do want people to understand it. It shouldn't be just throwing these things around because you know it's like good to do. The CoffeeScript is intended for an audience that already does know JavaScript and is familiar with the good practices.
Right.
Any
other things, any other features of the language that you would characterize as helping you express intent as opposed to something else?
Well, the classes are certainly expressing intent rather than... JavaScript forces you to define this constructor and then add things to its prototype, add methods or properties to its prototype. And the class syntax allows you to specify all those operations in one. So it's just making your intentions more clear.
Okay.
With most of the syntax, that's how it is.
Now, how would you contrast CoffeeScript to LiveScript?
So LiveScript is CoffeeScript with Haskell.
Does that mean a type system? A static type system?
No, that'd be Roy.
Darn.
you throw a feature on it, there's a language for it already. Or Faye, I believe, is another one that's up and coming.
So what do you mean that it's CoffeeScript with Haskell?
It has features like a function literal that auto-curries.
Or sectioning, very nice.
What else? Now that I think of it, nothing off the top of my head.
Well, that's already a big feature because that allows you to write point-free notation.
You can partially apply operators and pass them around. So instead of all the overhead of defining a function that takes an argument and applies, like, so it does some member access or just does we have one operand hard-coded to some operator. It does that for you.
Okay, that's really nice. Does it have laziness built in?
No.
Okay.
No, it does not.
All right.
That would be that would again stray away from the CoffeeScript family of languages.
It is a member of that CoffeeScript family.
So LiveScript is a fork of CoffeeScript.
Ah, okay. Where would you say that the JavaScript hardcores are going? Are they placing their bets on CoffeeScript, on LiveScript? Where are they going? If I wanted to write some code today that's still going to be alive 3 years from now, and I'm not going to have to be hauling around ancient compilers that don't work anymore, et cetera, et cetera.
That is a really good question. The JavaScript community perplexes me. Right now, there's a large group of people that really hate CoffeeScript for no reason. It's not like they don't like to use it themselves. They don't like people who like to use it.
It's very divided. That you're wrong, it's that you're evil.
I really don't understand the hatred for CoffeeScript and that among those community members. But your question about 3 years down the line, you want to write maintainable code. CoffeeScript is still a very young language. It's 3 years old, not even. So that's like asking 3 years ago where CoffeeScript will be.
Yeah, right, right.
It's very, very different than it used to be. It's very different than it used to be a year and a half ago.
Yeah.
So I guess in that case, I probably would recommend to stay away from this very, very new set of languages. But people are having successes in maintaining large projects written in CoffeeScript, and it's fairly stable. I would still call it in flux compared to many of these very large, very popular programming languages that it is among. But it's really on a case-by-case basis of whether or not it's appropriate.
It is quite interesting how this world is fragmenting even more. We have Dart coming along now.
Yeah.
We have ECMA 6, and we've got more and more people doing it. But I think part of it is due to the fact that JavaScript is so easy it's so easy comparatively to do metaprogramming in that people are going to pop up with compilers. And it very much reminds me of the Scheme days where it was just very easy to throw things together. Unlike creating a C++ compiler is a major undertaking, not for the faint of heart.
One thing to remember with the CoffeeScript family of languages is that each of them compile to the JavaScript you would have written is really what they claim.
Right.
And you always have that. So let's say, we wipe out all the CoffeeScript compilers from the world. We don't have any more CoffeeScript compilers.
Yeah.
You still have that compiled JavaScript. You can then take your project and continue
It doesn't die.
As a JavaScript company.
Right, right. And TypeScript has a slightly different appeal, and that is every JavaScript program is purportedly a legal TypeScript program.
Almost.
So, yeah, you still have to say declare or something like that. But if TypeScript dies, your code is not going to be dead. Same kind of idea. Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask: how did you get involved in this? How did you get pulled into this this morass?
I'm asked that during this conference. I've been asked that many, many times every day, almost, and I don't remember.
Wow. It's been that's depth. That's dedication.
One day I never heard of CoffeeScript. One day. CoffeeScript, I was really into CoffeeScript. I was working on it all the time. I know it was around the June to August time of 2010.
Yeah.
But really, I guess I had a lot going on at the time. And I as long as I can remember, I've been into it, I guess.
Had you had any exposure to anything like it before? Had you played around with Miranda or Haskell?
At that point, no. That was really
so. Maybe that's why it fascinated you, because it was this thing that was so utterly different.
Yeah, it was one of the first white space sensitive languages.
That means you had no Python.
No, I hadn't at the time, and I was really into JavaScript at the time, which I still am, of course.
Sure.
I'm into so many ECMAScript-related projects.
Yeah. Well, I especially love JavaScript because I can execute it in the server and I can execute it in the browser.
Yeah.
The main thing that made me serious about JavaScript was Node.js. Mm-hmm. Once I realized that I could have this kind of really seamless, low impedance mismatch, you know.
Use the same models on the server
impedance
as you do
match,
in
the client, and it just makes everything easier. Mm-hmm. And eval is a wonder. I love eval.
Are you Eric Meyer now?
I love eval.
I love mutations.
You love mutations. the reason I love eval is I love metaprogramming. So from the Scheme days, eval, you know, you wouldn't imagine writing Scheme code without quasi quote and unquote. Which is effectively what it can do. Mm-hmm. I know all the usual objections to it.
Of course.
And
you can't make any guarantees about your program
at all. Of course. But for getting some things off the ground, it's extraordinarily useful. Hmm. And we've had a couple of projects in which people have started off that way using eval very aggressively, and then when they want to control it and tame it, they just make a new implementation of eval. And we had one group that even went so far as to do a metacircular evaluator of JavaScript, so they could run in JavaScript an eval that sandboxed the incoming stream. Mm-hmm. I don't remember whether that group started off with Narcissus or whether they created their own JavaScript in JavaScript. But that's one way to deal with the madness. Well, anything else you want to throw my way? You want to sell me on using CoffeeScript, or you've already warned me off of it now? So.
Well, I've also warned you off of starting a project in JavaScript.
There is no
reason. I mean, always remember, worst comes to worst, you can always use the compiled output as your source now, because it's readable. It's how you would have written your JavaScript, probably better than you would have written your JavaScript for most users. It takes into account a lot of problems. It fixes things for you. I mentioned in my talk that most people don't know the catch variable in JavaScript is block scoped. Very, very little is block scoped in JavaScript.
Right.
And CoffeeScript fixes that for you. So there's actually inconsistencies among browsers. Some people's browsers don't properly block scope the catch variable, so we compile it in such a way that it's consistent among all browsers, and we just chose one scoping method.
Okay, very nice. Well, thanks a lot.
All right, thank you.